For the first time in IndyCar history, Marcus Ericsson wins a race and there wasn't a red flag involved. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. That's not a joke, it's a true fact. It's the first IndyCar race he's won without a red flag. Hey everybody, welcome to episode 679 of Motorsport 101. We've got both funny numbers in at once. And this time around, it's IndyCar's turn once again to lead our consent. And it's a race that a lot of people were very curious about, very interested in. It was the Grand Prix of Markham, the first time of asking. Brand new track for IndyCar, first on a five-year deal. And, well, it's safe to say it was a bit of a mixed bag in terms of reaction, response, how it played out. But in the end, chaos converged and Marcus Ericsson won his first race in, God, a good 3.5 years, as you do. Because when chaos devolves, Marcus Ericsson finds a way to win. Isn't that right, RJ O'Connell, my guest host for this episode?
No, I actually believed you when you said that this is the first win that Ericsson's had in IndyCar without a red flag. But honestly, I think a lot of us are just happy that he won. Hi, everybody. Just a couple of quick things from me on my end. Number one, I won't be on the show next week because I'll be in a whole other country. I've got a 3-week work trip in Japan coming up, mostly covering sports cars. Also, if you are in the United States and Canada and hear my voice and you have a subscription to Racer Plus, go watch / listen to me on commentary for the Super GT race at Suzuka on Sunday morning past midnight / Saturday night just before midnight, wherever you are in the United States and Canada. I don't know. It'd be great. That's all I have for me at this moment. God, what a nutty race this was.
I know RJ will never do himself justice because he's far too nice and modest about himself, but he crushed it the last time he did Super GT and he's going to crush it again. And I'm extremely jealous of his opportunity. He's going to be great. Go listen to him. It's going to be a great time. And I know RJ is like shrinking into a corn cob that I'm giving him a compliment live on the air, but I'm going
I'm not owned, but I'm just like, wow, it's such a busy weekend next weekend. I've got all of that. Oh, and plus I've got to cover all of IMSA at VIR from home. It's just with that and Formula One coming up, I just don't know how I'm going to have enough time in my day for anything else racing.
And yet somehow we both kind of kept half an eye on the Formula E season finale this past weekend because we were kind of curious to see how the last championship of this current era played out. Congrats to Pascal Wehrlein.
I wasn't dissing Formula E. I was just dissing what's up on that on the calendar. But you're right. Formula E, Gen 3 Evo finale, for better or for worse, it's over. The London XL experience is over. Congrats to Pascal Wehrlein for winning the Petty Olympics and also the Formula E Championship.
I mean, the best line of that was when he won the title right at the end of race two in London, and they actually played the full message right towards the end of the race where Pascal was just getting through the last couple of laps to get home. He's, I think he's fighting still with Antonio Felix da Costa. And as he passes Da Costa, he goes, sore fucking loser. Look at this guy still fighting me. I've beaten you 3 years in a row. Which is just... I'm glad that Da Costa, if nothing else, remembered right at the end, oh, wait, I'm a Jaguar driver. Let me just try and make Pascal's race as miserable as possible. And I'm not going to lie to you. It made for a great spectacle. Like, a lot of people... Sam Smith over at the race made this big huffing and puffing about, was this too far? Was this tactically too much? And I'm like, my brother in Christ, this is what Formula E's always been. It's always been chaos. It's always been insubordination and silly shit. Like that's the backbone of this series.
Yeah. Accusations from the Jaguar camp that Porsche's customer teams were out here running as second and third factory cars to help Pascal Wehrlein in a matter of team tactics that went over the line, I'd say. DaCosta taking matters of revenge into his own hands. You have Wehrlein just kind of dumping his only championship rival, Jake Dennis, who was really wasn't even involved in any of this. He was just trying to do the same thing that Wehrlein was doing, which was trying to become only the second driver ever to win multiple Formula E championships, which was crazy. And in the end, we get to the climax, which is Wehrlein and DaCosta's semi-private beef. I know their time as Porsche teammates did not end on good terms, and, well, it's spilled out in the public view.
Oh, yeah. That was ugly. If anything, it reminds me a little bit of Seb Blemmy's famous, I think it was season 3 meltdown in Vancouver, where he just, he takes his anger out.
Montreal. I remember this.
Okay. Like, where he takes his anger out on anyone that was prepared to listen. Like, Robin Fryan just got it in both barrels for no good reason. And it was like that as well. If you didn't know any better and you'd never seen Formula E before, you would never have guessed that Pascal Wehrlein had just won a world championship. By the way, he's just completely infatuated with hating on Antonio Felix da Costa.
I saw a picture on the podium ceremonies that kind of looked like he was flipping him off from the side.
Oh, yeah. Like, my man was hatering, hollering all up in XL's dancery. Like, you had to be there. And also, I'm kind of gutted I wasn't, because I know a lot of friends were actually at this race. I know Hazel was down there, and you may remember Hazel from our Formula E coverage days, and just generally is one of the long-running guests we've had on the show. Yeah. Just an all-round fantastic person, and even better ex-journo. Go check out our pub in Stratford. It's great. I've been there many a time. It's a great time. But, it was just classic Formula E. I mean, I was watching for Mitch Evans, and we had an outside chance of, we think we were 9 points off the title going into the final race, and we nearly had the last-minute attack mode to get up to the Mahindras, and I think it was Taylor Barnard who ended up winning his first Formula E race at the end of that, and just didn't have the pace. And I'm like, this is the sixth time Mitch Evans has been in a Formula E title decider, and it's the sixth time he's lost.
Going into the weekend, I was just like, nobody's talking about Mitch Evans, which means it's like prime position to finally go out and win one. What happens? Clunker happens in race one. He gets absolutely boned on a virtual safety car call in the middle of a race that really is a like Pascal Wehrlein hits the jackpot and wins the first race. Evans is lucky to get any points out of it. Leaves him with way too much to do in race two. Bless him, he tried. But hey, for Mitch Hamlin, it's a new era next year at Open.
Did you just call him Mitch Hamlin? I'll fight you. How dare you?
Would you agree or disagree with the slander name? I got nothing personal against Mitch nowadays, but this is just what the kids do nowadays.
Annoyingly, I can't really criticize the factual accuracy of this nickname, because if there was someone that was a nearly man in motorsport all time, Mitch Evans would probably be up there alongside Denny Hamlin. But although I do think Denny Hamlin will actually win the Cup Series title this year, so look, I heard it here first.
It's Denny's year on Motorsport 101.
I'm calling it right here and now. It is Denny's year. If not, I will give like £11 to free charities of Kira's choosing. I know she's in the chat and she's a huge Denny Hamlin fan. So I will donate £11, his number, to three different charities. There you go. I'm that confident. Book it. It's Denny Hamlin's year.
Yeah. It's a more serious title format, which means, Joey Logano's gaining momentum. But yeah, this is the end of the Gen 3 era, an era that inspired hope and also led us to stop talking about Formula E full time. Will Generation 4 be different? Hopefully. Does it feel like Formula E is losing some of its original scuffed magic from the early days? Yes. Lucas Degrassi is leaving, for better or worse. Sebastian Buemi's leaving, for better or worse. Times are changing. The tracks are changing all the time. We'll see what happens in 2027.
You know what's wild about that as well, before we move on? Seb Buemi openly said on the radio as the second race was over, as his last race for Envision and seemingly his last in the series, I do not agree with the decision. And he repeated that point two or three times over that he really did not want to be there. Look, people have asked, actually, reached out to me and asked on Instagram, like, Dre, are you covering Formula E Season 4 on this show? To which I will say, never say never. Me and Cameron Buckley both made a pact we would watch the first three races of Gen 4 at the end of the year, early next year, just to see how the Gen 4 car goes.
Ain't shit else on. It's the middle of winter. We don't even know where the first three races are going to be held, because do you think at this current state that we're racing in Saudi Arabia to start the season?
Not a fucking chance. But yeah, it's... We'll see what happens, is what I would say. Like, I mean, we do need off-season stuff to fill after Formula One ends in December. So, all I will say is, you've got a chance of at least it being on holdover. It's on probation. We'll see. No promises.
Yeah.
But, yeah, let's talk about IndyCar at Markham coming up very, very shortly, because there's a lot to get through from that race. But, yeah, we'll do the housekeeping at the end. We can save that till then. But because there's a lot to get through. I'll narrate this one for once, because this is a lot of shit. But right. IndyCar's debut race weekend at the streets of Markham got off to a rather embarrassing start. A lack of tyres and barriers at the track meant, despite IndyCar using all of their staff to support the promoters, Green Savory Racing Promotions, formerly of St. Pete, Mid-Ohio, and Portland, all Friday running had to be cancelled while the track was actually finished. So, when we did get going again, it was a compressed schedule. Both practice sessions, the one we were meant to have on Saturday and the one that was on Friday, was moved over. So, yeah, essentially we had a condensed Titan schedule. The big story is Kyle Kirkwood knocked out in round one of qualifying on a street circuit, of all things. He got caught up in his own teammate Will Power's spin, had his lap time ruined, and then, of course, that broke out a red flag while they had to recover Power's car. So, yeah, Kirkwood lost his chance at a push lap, tire heat up, all of that stuff. Oh, and Alex Palou made a rare, check out my notes here, error. Is he allowed to do that? Is he allowed to have one of those? I don't know. Rumor has it he hit the wall in round two. Had to start from 11th on the grid. His worst start in IndyCar since Nashville 2024. It was only P11. It wasn't even all that bad in the end, but it was 11th place in the end. Louis Foster would take a shock pole position, his second in his IndyCar career, ahead of Christian Lundgaard and Scott McLaughlin. The race itself was carnage. Somehow clean until Mick Schumacher was the first man in the wall on lap 16 for hitting the wall at turn 4. Little do we know in IndyCar that, as we've said many a time, cautions breed cautions, and over the next, 45 laps, we would have 5 more cautions and 25 laps of yellow to settle them all out. I'll run you through the quick list. Caution number 2. Marcus Armstrong gets tagged and then spins on the exit of the horseshoe thanks to Stingray Rob. He also does a stupid, and when the pack is coming back through under yellow, despite the marshal telling him to stop, he guns it and gets stuck in the inside wall. Armstrong, that was one of the stupidest things I've ever seen anybody in a race car do, and he's very lucky he wasn't parked for the rest of the day, because that is super stupid. He was given a 10-second stop and hold, which is about the biggest penalty that IndyCar gives out nowadays. So that was a thing. Dennis Hauger was next. On the third caution, he gets caught in a braking zone having to pinch. He spins out Scott Dixon. Dixon then spins backwards towards the outside wall. He clatters into Christian Rasmussen in the process. Rasmussen's day is done. Dixon's able to continue, but he has to go into the pits with broken suspension damage. And I think it was his wishbone that was broken. He loses 6 laps. His day is done, effectively, right there and then. After that, Louis Foster, who has to come in because he's on the brink of taking emergency service, is now trying to fight his way back through the field from 12th. He tries to pass Marcus Ericsson, goes in way too hot, clips the inside wall and bounces into the outside wall at turn three. The pole sitter is out and was looking really, really good for the win as well. It has to be said, it was easily Foster's greatest performance in IndyCar until that wall hit. That was another caution. Then we had Cole Kirkwood, who did the exact same thing at turns three and four. The king of the streets out for an error of his own volition. Well, he ends up finishing in 21st place on the day. And then, just when we thought everything was clear, Nolan Siegel spins out Joseph Newgarden at the horseshoe as well. Six cautions, and it all shakes out into a final 29-lap sprint for the finish, essentially, because there was no other cautions after that. As it shook out, this was a weird situation. Marcus Ericsson was already like 30 laps deep into a stint. He pushes out a 15-second lead because he's going all out, has to take another stop. He's on a full aggression strategy to run his two-stopper. So he's trying to put gaps on Grosjean. Grosjean's on a mega save. This is a classic Dale Coyne strategic roll of the dice. He's got to go 37 laps on a 29-lap fuel tank to try and make the end. He's the net leader on track. Alex Palou was doing the same, running long, not quite so bad. I think he was on a 34 lap final stint. Will Power was on a 30 lap stint, but he was on the softer red tire. In the end, Ericsson bullied his way through to the front. He even barged out his own teammate Will Power at the horseshoe before passing Palou and then Grosjean with five laps to go to take his fifth IndyCar Series win and his first in 63 races. The last time Marcus Ericsson won was the season opener in St. Pete back in 2023. Romain Grosjean, poor man, cried in the car after his sixth runner-up finish in an IndyCar race since joining the series. And still looking for his first open wheel win in 15 years. RJ, remember the last time Romain Grosjean won a single seater race?
It was in his GP2 series title year in 2011, which, fun fact, was in between his Formula One stints. Remember, Romain Grosjean came out of GP2 midway through 2009 because they hired Nelson Piquet Jr., for which Nelson Piquet handled it very cordially, without causing any chaos on the way out. Grosjean and the rest of Renault were absolutely terrible for the remainder of 2009. He gets demoted back to GP2, builds back up, wins the title in 2011, and then goes up to Formula One on a more regular basis starting in 2012.
Indeed. Yeah, ironically, that race was also commentated by Will Buxton, 15 years apart. Who would have thought it? Will Power scored his third podium of the season in third, with Alex Palou fourth, David Malukas having to take a late pit stop because he broke his toe link hitting the wall in the final stint of the race and falling to 17th. And as mentioned, Cole Kirkwood in P21. It extended Palou's championship lead up to 133 points. It gives him an outside chance of actually clinching at the Chino Dust 250 this weekend. It's a long shot. He's got to outscore a big old Chase Impact by 30 points. It's probably not going to happen, but it's still, mathematically, it is doable, essentially. That will be Washington this weekend. Well,
yeah.
Before we get into all the action, RJ, in general, there is a lot of action. The fact that we didn't get any on Friday, I think, kind of has to be discussed a little bit here because it wasn't a great look watching it in real time on seeing the pictures. I think on Thursday was when the penny, I think, started to drop that this place is kind of unfinished.
Yeah. One important detail out of all of this is that the Markham Street Circuit is based near a Greater Ontario transit station. You saw the little train going above head. That's the Markham tram line. That's basically a lot of people's way into and out of the suburb of Markham, right? Now, of course, Greater Ontario Transit owns the parking lot that takes place in that, part of the track is based around. IndyCar did not get the keys to that parking lot until the Wednesday of the race. So in order to complete all the setup, they had about, 36 hours to get it all finished. Less than 48, I know for sure. And as it turns out, for the staff, it was not enough. It was, for Green Savory, a promoter that, generally speaking, has done well with St. Pete, but came under fire last week in Portland because I think a lot of people had suddenly come to the realization, like, Portland is kind of stagnated. Is it time that we rethink going back here? And then, of course, like Mid-Ohio, which I know Mid-Ohio has been a longtime fixture at the IndyCar paddock, but ask anybody in the industry, they'll tell you that the facilities have gone, shall we say, unreplenished in recent years.
For the pilot,
I don't know how much of that is part of the promoter's problem, but yeah, suffice to say, it was not a good look for the promoter. And I know that American Oval Wheel Racing has fallen very, very far in the last 25 years. I think Cam described this as the kind of embarrassment that would only happen in CART immediately after Andrew Craig left.
he called it Andrew Craig-esque on Twitter, which...
That's damn, right. That that's the old head of CART, by the way. He was the guy who presided over all the good times in the immediate aftermath of the split. But, yeah, they didn't lose the whole race, but it's not ideal losing a whole day. I think anybody that lived through the debacles of the first ever Las Vegas Grand Prix in Formula One can certainly attest to this. And, again, it's just not – and this goes into another point about the Markham circuit itself. It is going to be a long-term fixture on the calendar because how we got here in the first place is that the Toronto Stadium, where Toronto FC plays, had to be renovated for the World Cup, right? So now the World Cup's gone. Why aren't we going back to exhibition place? Well, they're carrying a bunch more public work, including road construction in the area that, according to my colleague Natalie Johnson, who is from the area and is very connected with the Canadian motorsport scene, is not going to be finished until 2032. So I'm already missing it. I would really love to have exhibition place plaque. And it's not to say that Markham's a bad calendar addition to the calendar. It's just that this was not a good start.
Losing a day's running is always embarrassing. That's never an ideal situation. I know the fans that were there on Friday got in for free. They had to donate to a local charity, I believe. I think it was the Make-A-Wish Foundation over there to get in. So it was free, but not really, but kinda. You know what I mean? And look, even so, like, they're there to expect action. They want to see cars on track. And, you know, they had a big undercard. They had, you know, the USF Pros and the 2000s were there. And we had a NASCAR Canada race as well. So not being able to see a good diverse region of cars on the first run round this track for the first time was meant to be a really exciting thing. And that Friday was gone. I know I spoke to Joey Barnes about this as well. If you don't know Joey Barnes, Joey does IndyCar's coverage for the Motorsport Network. Yep. Good egg. Love Joey. Worked with him before. And he said that GSR has got a bit of a reputation for being a bit frugal with the events that it promotes. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily just the barriers. It was also the big screen that apparently didn't go up until, you know, Sunday, the actual race day. So it wasn't there for qualifying. Apparently a lack of portable toilets, which is never ideal. And as you mentioned, RJ, just general rumblings about the state of Mid-Ohio, the state of Portland and their races in general, and how there's not a lot of growth there. They've kind of become stagnant rounds. So when it gets to a point where you're blatantly short on, and this is the important stuff, the safety features like barriers and tires, and having to apparently import tires in from Mosport Park down the road, and to the point where Doug Bowles, the president of IndyCar, is openly criticizing you in a statement on Friday. And look, we all like Doug Bowles here. Doug is one of the nicest people and one of the just genuinely good dudes in North American open-wheel motorsport. if Doug's putting you on blast in a public statement, you must have really pissed him off, because, like, IndyCar's track guys were there to help out and support on Thursday and Friday, and they still couldn't get there in time. That's how bad this was.
Also, to your point about having to go get tires from down the road at Mosport, down the road in this instance is a 64-kilometer drive pretty much across the York region.
That's a good couple of hours there and back, basically, assuming you stick to the speed limit. 43
minutes, according to Google Maps, if you were to do it right about 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah, so, you know, losing an entire day's running for that is embarrassing. It's a bad look for the series. I mean, look, this is at a time where I saw Doug himself had to answer questions in a Zoom call about the possibility of more international races again, because people are keen for the series to expand again. I mean, and I can see why. People are excited about the IndyCar product in the sense of the ratings are good. They've had a genuine good bump up. I know fans are generally quite happy with the promotion of the series since Fox took over a year and change ago. It's in, like, it's certainly in a more optimistic place than it's been in years past. So Doug was out here talking about, you know, never say never. It's a possibility we might want to try and go to different international places. Of course, it's going to be a North American dominant series. Everybody reasonable knows that. But a couple of days later, having to scrap a day's running at your one race in Canada, a market that is, as you said, John, they've had for 40 years, they've had a market in Canada. It's a bad look.
Yeah, specifically, they've had the Toronto market, an exhibition place, and you've already, no matter, there will be people that have gone to this new Markham event because it's the races that's close to them. They'll turn out for it no matter what. But let's be real, when you move venues, you do still lose people. And then you also have people that you want to try and bring in. And when you lose a whole day of the event like this, it is going to sour them on the possibility of coming back, you know?
Yeah.
Like, for all the shit that we said about Nashville races being a clusterfuck, those races always got, every session happened pretty much in a timely manner.
Yeah, and they were disrupted by an act of God. That happens. This was self-inflicted from promoters that really should know better, quite frankly. You know, you're going to be much more prepared to forgive if weather gets in the way. You know, that's just one of those
I'm at the street circuit that we had before. Another street circuit that was disrupted by works going on around a stadium that have gone on so long that we pretty much accept that it's never coming back.
Yeah,
at least not for a while.
At least not for a darn while, you know. And that's only that promoter's second biggest fumble over his career. But yeah, I mean, like I said, just not a good look. I mean, again, props to some of the drivers. it's one of those ones where, and also I want to say as well, big props to Alex Palou for going into the stands and taking selfies and signing autographs. We're very lucky to have that dude. He was the first person into the stands to say sorry for the lack of action out there. Like people hate this man unironically because he wins too much. We are so lucky to have him. I swear to God.
Yeah, but he's a real speed champion.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but by the time we did get going and we got a race in the end, RJ, and I mean, let's talk about it. Marcus Ericsson, an IndyCar race winner again. I mean, at one point, I wasn't sure whether Marcus was ever going to get one of these again. And it's been over 3.5 years since his last win in the series. And his you forget he's won 5 of these now. Like, there was a time where Marcus was a genuine elite driver in this series. And he's had it rough for the last couple of years.
Yeah, because this tenure at Andretti Global has not gone according to plan. He comes out of Chip Ganassi Racing, right? He is subsidizing the team while he is being successful. And the point, Marcus Ericsson decides, you know what? My value has never been higher. I want to be paid to race rather than pay to race. Andretti offers him that opportunity. And the first 2 years are, for the most part, an unmitigated disaster. So much that we're going into 2026 thinking, right, is Marcus Ericsson just on borrow time, keeping the seat warm before Dennis Hauger inevitably steps up? Well, Ericsson's got the contract extension. He is driven so very well to keep Hauger at bay and keep his, at least his short-term future in IndyCar secure. Because remember, deceptively, he's 36 this year. He's not going to have many more good years left in front of him. He's None. Driven like a driver, you think, like more podiums and maybe a win is on the way. And in the second half of the race, he was just impervious. I mean, it felt like it took him a while to get past Alex Palou during his last stint in the red tires. But once he did, he just ate up the gap to Romain Grosjean. And it felt almost emblematic of Romain Grosjean's career. Like, isn't that kind of symbolic that his old car, the Andretti 28, is the one that's driving past him to deny him yet another victory in the IndyCar series?
I'll say this much. The back 29 laps of this race was the best I've seen of Marcus Ericsson in IndyCar. That was him taking a race by the neck and winning it with his will. Like, I've there's always been an element of, and I made the joke at the top of the intro about Marcus because it's a true fact, like I mentioned earlier. All of his previous four IndyCar races had red flags in them, had crazy shit happen in them where he's benefited. And a lot of people, I think, use that to put him down, like his 500 win, his win in the original Nashville track we went to, etc. And again, I think a part of this is because of Marcus's F1 background, because his F1 career didn't really pan out.
Already on social media, people have said, like, oh, Grosjean and Ericsson finished 1-2 in a race. This just shows how terrible IndyCar is. And to somebody's point they made, Marcus Ericsson is not the benchmark for which to compare Formula One to IndyCar, right? No. We know this.
No, and look, people develop differently in racing. People will adapt to different cars differently. For what you might not like about Formula One, you might prefer in an Indy car, you might prefer in a sports car. Who knows? Like, driving's a very complicated art. There's a million ways that you can skin a cat in that sense. And you just don't know how it's going to turn out until you do it. When Marcus had good machinery underneath him at Chip Ganassi Racing, he was excellent. He was top six in the championship 3 years in a row, and he won a 500. That's elite performance. That's something that we didn't expect from Alex Palou until he got really, really good really quickly. No, and for me, just because his F1 career didn't work out doesn't mean that he's going to... It doesn't mean it makes IndyCar worse by his presence. That's not how that works, in my opinion. And yeah, if you want to pick on Marcus Ericsson, you pick about the first 2 years he had at Andretti, where he was 15th and 20th in points.
Yeah.
That's why this win was such a surprise, because the first 2 years of his tenure at Andretti were rough. He was on the hot seat this year until a week ago when it was announced he'd signed a new contract. And even then, he's still kind of on a hot seat because he's only on a one-year deal. It's the prove-it contract. It's the... prove you're still good enough to be here, or we're going to move on from you next year anyway. So, all that being said, Marcus is ninth in points this year. This is a significant turnaround, and I don't want to necessarily say it's been coming, but what I would say is that he's in a much better place in terms of form. He's been a lot more consistent this year, and the way IndyCar is, if you're competent as a driver, sometimes the chips will fall on your lap in this series and you can win a race or two in it. That's just how it is. It's not a shock that Ericsson won this race to me, because he was brilliant, and I think a lot of people aren't talking about it. That stint at the end of that block of cautions where Marcus pulls out a 15-second lead on Grosjean, which opened the door for him to have that final 21-lap stint at the end to win the race. was the best he's ever looked in IndyCar. That was that was a classic combination of Andretti being brilliant at street tracks, Marcus's pace being insane, and brilliant tactical nous to stick it out during all those cautions and then stretching out to what was ultimately a 38-lap stint in the middle of that race to open the door for that Banzai final run. And it was brilliant. Like,
yeah,
that's exactly the Marcus we were hoping for when he joined Andretti.
100%. And look, on the other side of the coin, look, Romain Grosjean, when he got to the front with about and with 10 laps to go, he's got a comfortable lead. Ericsson's squabbling below. He thinks, right, this is my George Springer moment. In Game 7 of the American League Championship Series, I'm going to be the hero. Touch them all, Rogue Row. You'll never win a bigger race in your life. And then Marcus Ericsson comes in swinging like Miguel Rojas and Will Smith at the end and just rips out of you. I'll say this. I'm sorry to rub salt in the wound to our Toronto sports fans who may be listening. I mean, it's only gotten worse since then for both Toronto and Seattle, as it turns out. But Grosjean and Dale Coyne picking up second place. Grosjean coming off a year out of the sport. Dale Coyne Racing coming off of what's been a pretty wretched form in the second run of form in the second half of 2026. And remember, just 2 years ago, we were kind of worried that if there was going to be a team that was going to fold out of existence first out of all the established powers in IndyCar, it was going to be Dale Coyne Racing. They were in such a bad state of shape, but man, this felt like 2021 Romain Grosjean was back in a damn big way.
I remember.
Just like all the other times of 2021 Romain Grosjean.
Yeah, it's like winding the jack in the box. And just when you think this is going to be the one where you win, it still punches you in the nuts at the end. You remind me of the throwback of 2021 and Grosjean's debut and the amount of excitement there was for Grosjean being in IndyCar. Of course, this was fresh off, you know, the going viral of what happened to him in Bahrain the year prior, where he nearly burned to a crisp, the poor guy. Him taking that Phoenix nickname and then taking it to IndyCar, that pole position he had at the Indy Road course, the fact I think he was second that day in the race itself. Once upon a time, people were really excited for Grosjean in IndyCar, and it just did not work out. Like, I think once the honeymoon period kind of ended, once he got to Andretti, he got a big team seat, and then that started out great, quickly went into meltdown over there, lost his job, went to the Lamborghini side of the sports car wagon.
Don't forget the Yunkos ride that he didn't get to keep his ride because Connor Daly, you know, snuck away a nice little podium on his way out.
Whatever gets you into the leader's circle, you know?
Exactly.
It's everything that went against Grosjean did. And there was a lot of question marks about his reputation in the series and his temperament. Because he lost his composure so many times when he was an Andretti driver, where it was like, are you still good at this, Roman? And again, that was a brilliant drive. And we know that Dale Coyne loves to roll the dice on strategic gambles, because when you're a lower-end team, why the hell not, quite frankly? The worst that's going to happen is you're going to finish in the same place you normally do anyway. So why not go for it? And he went for it there. And that had to be a 37-lap final stint to win. That is insane. And that is a crazy amount of save. And
listen to it on the radio, and for a second I thought he had it. And then Ericsson just eviscerated that gap between them, because it was about 3 seconds once he got past Pelot for second place. I'm just thinking, man, all Romain Grosjean needs is just stabilize that gap, and he's got it. And then the gap disappeared.
Let's put it to you this way. Grosjean drove his fuel save so well, it forced Alex Pelot into a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Pelot was gunning him down. He was within half a second of him. and he very nearly lost the front into turn six and had to correct himself. He lost 2 seconds, and Palou could not get that time back. There was a time around 15 to go where you're thinking, oh shit, Palou's going to end up winning this. Like, because we've seen it so many times where Palou steals one. And this is the classic, oh, well, Palou's going to come and clean this up and he's going to steal the field's lunch money and get out of Dodge after, by his standards, quite a scrappy weekend. He had the crashing qualifying. At one point, he was pushed out wide. He lost a boatload of places in terms of track position. He caused Rossi's puncture by accident. It was a scrappy race by Palou's standards. And you think he's nearly going to steal this one. And then Grosjean broke Alex. That doesn't happen. You know, and Alex didn't win. Ericsson comes through, and with 5 to go, Ericsson puts down the winning pass. And you can tell, he drives away, because obviously Grosjean, I mean, Grosjean had 94 seconds of push to pass, and he could not use it because he was too close on fuel. Uh-huh. And Ericsson was on full attack mode because fuel was not an issue. He was on a 21 lap stint to finish. Yeah. You could see why Grosjean was crying in the car afterwards. He admitted afterwards in the press conference that he cried on the way back to the pits, because probably just out of sheer frustration, because he's been so close. It's actually startling that a driver as talented as him has gone 15 years since he last won a single-seater race. That is crazy.
And on the IndyCar side of things, you know, I'm old enough to remember a couple of drivers that come to mind that you just think, how did they never win a race? A generation before this, it was the Brazilian Vitor Mira, who had a lot of very good drives, was always exciting, was always close enough to winning races, and never did. And then before that, remember when Raul Boisel, especially in the early 90s, was like at the height of his game in IndyCar? Yeah, surprisingly, he never won a race, despite being like a top six driver in kart in the early 90s, overlapping the Mansell years, funnily enough. But I mean, it'd be kind of funny if he somehow in the next, maybe as soon as next weekend, goes out and wins it, and that's the one we're all checked out on. But
it would be the most Romain Grosjean thing of all time if he wins at the Freedom 250, and we're all just like, well, if nothing else, it's funny that Donald Trump has to give the trophy to a Frenchman. Well, technically a Swiss guy. Yeah. technically because he was born in Switzerland. Yeah.
Depends on the form book, really. On this weekend, he felt a lot more French, if we are using the Andy Murray syndrome theory.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
They both still great have drive. It. Don't use them to beat IndyCar over the head. IndyCar's got plenty of stuff you can complain about. Midfield carnage at the end. I could scarcely believe, as I was listening to it on the radio, how Louis Foster threw that race away. And seeing it back, yo. Oh, dude.
It's bad. It's not even like it was an act of God or a mechanical or somebody else initiating contact.
He just sent it in too hot. And he had, up until that point, the fastest car of the day. Like, he has a setback in the pits. Doesn't matter. He's, like, zipping through the field. When he was up at the front, up until Schumacher's crash, which, oh, boy. Talk about another guy who just really threw away some much-needed stock in the offseason. Foster was just balling all day, and that's got to be so disappointing.
It was the best he'd been in IndyCar in his career to date. It's frustrating for me because from 2024, when he was destroying the field in Indy Next, I was like, this dude's got something here. Mm-hmm. And I was always nervous when he joined RLL because I'm like, well, look, Christian Lundgaard did a lot of miraculous things in that team to get himself the McLaren gig he ended up going to. And I was like, well, maybe Foster can be another Lundgaard, potentially, because the talent was there and he dominated Next. And it's been frustrating following Foster for the last year and a half because, you know, he's had a couple of good results here and there. He's had a bit of the cartoon anvil treatment as well. In a few races here and there, a couple of pole positions. He had a couple of the seventh places this season. This was, by a country mile, the best Foster has looked at IndyCar. He was the dude this weekend. The fastest man around this track. He was on pole by nearly half a second. He dominated this weekend until it mattered most. So, of course, he takes a big old lunge on Marcus. He's about 20 miles an hour too hot. Clatters the inside wall, clatters the outside wall. And I'm just like, you've got to be shitting me. Really?
He had more laps than any other driver, 32 to Romain Grosjean's 28. Marcus Ericsson led 21. Other 2024 Indy Nets grads who had great opportunities and kind of threw them in the trash like Kobe, Nolan Siegel led 8 laps, was off sequence, was at least looking like for a solid top 5 result, and then ran to the back of Joseph Newgarden, making me doubly sad.
Again, like, he was on the winner's strategy. He was on Grosjean's strat. Like, he was... Like,
Grosjean got past him because he did make an error at the horseshoe, a.k.a. the Macau Grand Hotel hairpin at home, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
At least a top five was coming. It wasn't a good day for the Indy Nets class of 2024 at Markham when all of a sudden done. Mick Schumacher has a prime opportunity to build himself more stock in the offseason. He throws it in the wall. Just a shit day from Meyer Shank Racing in general.
Kyle Collette
looks like he is about to get his season back on track, and it couldn't have gotten any much worse.
So, Kyle Collette crashes on Saturday morning during first practice. They get him back out for qualifying, and then they underfuel the car in qualifying, so he ends up parking it on the side of the road and then causing a red flag to drop him out in round one. And then on the opening lap of the race, he gets suspension damage and his day is effectively done right there. And then he ends up finishing 19th. And I'm just like, Kyle Collette, I don't even know what to make of Collette this season, because it's like he's had multiple races where he's had really good opportunities and the results have not been there. Whether it be he himself crashing during an oval race, the technical issue he had in Gateway when he was running in P8 and his engine blew. And this weekend was a write-off for Collette. And this is a guy who was apparently at one point getting MSR rumors. Like you said, I think MSR is now cursed in the sense of if you're hinted to go to that team, you're going to get struck by like a Zeus-level thunderbolt.
Yeah. It happened to Collette. It happened to Mick Schumacher. Who knows what's going to happen? Put a pin in that for a second. Rinus VK finished 7th with a damaged front wing. It wasn't quite below levels at Exhibition Place a couple of years back, but it was still a very gutsy performance from another guy who is, again, building that offseason stock. Pat O'Ward comes from the back to finish 5th. Will Power comes from the back to finish 3rd. God, just a nutty first race. I'm very glad we got a finished track at the end, because that was at least something we're talking about.
Look, it was a 4 out of 10 race with a 9 out of 10 finish. You know, that's what it was. And ultimately, I think the last 29 or so laps of that race, the last green flag run to the flag, was as good as IndyCar gets on road and street courses. Why? Because, we had strategic convergence. You had Grosjean running super, super long, trying to survive. You had Pelot on his signature black tire stint, trying to gun him down. You had Power running semi-long on softs. You had Ericsson on maximum aggression. Hell, even Pato O'Ward was in that second group by the end of the race on a three-stop strategy, and how he had late race pace and how he nearly got on the podium himself. That strategic convergence, seeing it all come together and not knowing who was going to win this race till about 4 laps out from the end, was fantastic. It was drama. It was intense. You had overtakes left, right, and center. I think that was like 240 for position over the course of the race. Can't scoff at that.
At a track that shouldn't be conducive to overtaking, there were stretches, especially early on in the race, where it just looked like nobody's making a move because nobody can make a move.
Annoyingly, this track might be onto something. It wasn't perfect, but the one thing I did notice was by the time it did get going again, the drivers were pretty unanimous in saying, now this is a great layout. It's a fun layout. It's fast. It's flowing. There's passing opportunities. You've got to work hard, you know, to be able to extract lap time around it. Like, the drivers seemingly really like this track. And I don't think it's perfect. I think the horseshoe hairpin probably needs a bit of work. I think the entry probably needs to be expanded or made wider.
It's a bit silly. It's a bit silly. And look, Markham is a pretty quaint suburb for, you know, the rich folks. The kind of people that would just be like, hey, there's a Ford on the ballot. I don't even care if there's a video of this dude smoking crack rocks. That's our mayor.
That's our guy.
No, yeah, that's our guy. You know, that's suburban Toronto, right? It looks drab. It makes you miss what we used to have. But I will say, once they actually finish the track layout, I kind of like it. Certainly, and I know this is not being biased because of the socio-political element of it. Looks a lot more interesting on paper than does the Freedom 250 layout.
The Freedom 250 layout is a glorified Roval. That layout sucks. That layout is just my first F1 track.
Look, we got all the monuments on one course.
Yeah, and that's going to get boring very quickly, especially when you're going to be watching race cars doing 160 miles an hour around it. This was a genuinely interesting layout. It wasn't perfect, but you had good racing. You could follow. There wasn't a huge dirty air effect. You could take a risk with a lunge at turn 3, turn 5, and turn 6. We saw people making moves at the chicane on the back end as well. It was a lot more raceable than I thought it was going to be going in. And that's a positive sign. I think it was a good track, and it will only get better in the remaining 4 years of the contract that they signed for this place, because this was the first year of a repaved circuit. It was always going to cause some teething problems. Like, again, offline, if you went wide, you were in trouble. And of course, the horseshoe wasn't great. I think if you expand that and maybe cut down the exit a little bit, so you could actually overtake round the outside of the horseshoe, which we saw Louis Foster do to Alex Palou earlier on in that race. So it's rare you get a hairpin where outside passes are viable. So maybe just open up the entry, make it look a bit like a guitar, for example. And I think you're actually in good shape. I thought it was a good track. I think this is a keeper. Just organize it better next time, please, you know?
Yeah. Have more time to finish up the track, you know, by working with the local transit authority, right? It's got to get better because, you know, at the end of the day, like I said, people are still going to miss what we used to have. That's just the nature of the beast. We are nostalgic creatures. To a point, we all know Alex Palou's winning this championship. He's going to win 4 in a row. He's going to win 5 in total. I'm curious about the battle for second, because Kyle Kirkwood is second in the standings. He had a massive points opportunity that he just threw in the wall. He's got 409 points. David Malukas is 4 points behind him. We know he's hungry for that first win. Christian Lundgaard is another 2 points behind them. Another solid top 10 finish, and again, building that off-season momentum where, let's be real, if he's not in the 5 car, it's a shock. Pato Ward is only 24 points behind Kirkwood for second place. And in case any of them have a slip, Joseph Newgarden is in sixth with 2 short ovals as bankers, as is Scott McLaughlin, also with 2 short ovals as bankers, and they drive for Penske. I mean, Drake, who do you think's going to get second out of this?
It's an intriguing fight because they've all got strengths and weaknesses in certain places. They all have different makeups as drivers, and there's no outright favorable schedule here in the sense of we've got a street track coming up, then we've got 2 oval races on a short oval, and then you've got a road course to close out the year at Laguna Seca. I personally think it's going to be David Malukas. And I think the reason why is I think he's the best all-rounder at the moment of those guys all mentioned. Two short ovals really goes in his favour. We all know that Penske love a good short oval. They are typically dominant on them. They have been for a few years. Malukas is not a million miles off what Newgarden and McLaughlin are as oval racers. Wouldn't surprise me at all if Malukas got his first win during that Milwaukee weekend somewhere.
It has to be.
Like, Lundgaard is, you know, he'll have a great chance at the Freedom. He'll have a great chance at Laguna Seca because he's been so good on road and street tracks this year. It's crazy, especially on the road courses. He's been phenomenal there this season. But he's got two ovals to get through. And that's where Pato O'Ward might come into play. Like, Pato is... Pato was second in the championship last year. He's one of the few dudes I say is a three-tool driver who can win in all three formats if he's feeling it. And I don't know. Like, it's weird as well because, like, I think for the second year in a row, Kirkwood's kind of tailing off at the back end of the year again. He did this last year as well where he was strong first two-thirds of the year. Last third, he seemingly drops off. It's an interesting table. I think it's David Malukas, personally. I think if I was a betting man, he's only 4 points behind Kirkwood. And I think on a good day, Malukas can win any oval, and on a good day he can be a top five Roman street course guy. He's got the pace. Absolutely. So if I had to guess, I think it's Malukas.
That first win is going to come at Milwaukee. Like, that's a padlock, book it, ship it.
I would be
shocked
if he didn't win one of the two. If he doesn't win one of those two, it's only because another Penske is beating him.
Yeah. Could be McLaughlin. Could be Newgarden. Could not been as dreadful as it was this time last year for Penske, but, you know, where's the bar? Other silly season news. I know there's a lot of moving pieces going on. We still don't know who's filling the nine car. It's likely Christian Lundgaard. Where's Rinus VK going? Is he staying at Juncos? Is he going somewhere else? Who's filling the 66 car? We've had an interesting development because for the first time, there is a tangible Yuki Tsunoda rumor to IndyCar that is not just predicated on, well, Yuki Tsunoda's been backed by Honda his whole career, so of course he'd wind up there when he goes out of F1. No, to Joey Barnes' credit, he broke the story that for the first time, he's been seriously linked to an IndyCar seat, specifically the 66 car at Meyer-Shank Racing. There's also been talks. I mean, it's better than Coyne. I'd say that. Look, I just gave Coyne its flowers, but let's be real, there's levels to this.
Of course. It's very interesting, this one, isn't it? Because, like, it's funny. Like, I mentioned in a video short I put out today that Yuki Tsunoda was in talks with Meyer-Shank Racing, and someone on Instagram put it to me in a Q&A question. What do you think about the possibility of Tsunoda going to MSR? And I kind of was like, you know, people have looked at the Honda link, and I'm like, you know, it's an obvious link, yes, but no guarantee that, you know, there was a serious talk. I mean, just because he's a Honda driver doesn't mean he's going to end up in IndyCar or wants to drive an IndyCar. There was no an interview with Yuki saying, oh, I'm keen to race another series or
He did the demo run, and that was about it. You know, there had been flimsy rumors of him going to Coyne when the gambling stop or whatever. I don't know. But this seems like it's serious, and it would at least be a good fit for him and a good team for him to really get experience. But the one thing I do hope is that if this happens, don't expect him to be Takuma Sato right out of the box, because two Indy 500 wins at a close call in 2012 will make it easy to forget that Takuma Sato did not have this IndyCar thing figured out of the box. Matter of fact, Takuma Sato, like, his first couple of years was negative value. It was only that 2012 Indy 500 where he really took that step forward. It took a big step forward. Multiple wins in IndyCar, inside and outside the 500, but there will always be that link because, oh, he's a Japanese guy that's a Honda contracted driver. It's going to go the same way. I don't think it'd go the same way, but I'd be fascinated to see this. Does this mean Kakuno Shinoda is shut out of his seat? Not necessarily.
No.
There's a possibility when that third car comes online, they could have both Yuki Tsunoda and Kakuno Shinoda. Well, I'll just have to see how it all develops.
I mean, great to have that level of Japanese influence if you could have Yuki Tsunoda and Kakuota under one roof as a Honda factory driver in IndyCar. That's some nice promotional tie-ups you've got going on there for you all of a sudden at MSR as a three-car unit, as one of the teams on Chip Ganassi's Technical Alliance partnership list as well. That's a very strong team alongside Marcus Armstrong, who has had the cartoon anvil fall on his head this season, but he's a top 10 driver in the series when he's on it. So, Yuki Tsunoda was a guy who I always thought there was a good F1 driver there, but I think he was in the wrong environment. I think he was in a team where they wanted another Max, and he was never going to be that.
They weren't patient enough to try and let him sink or swim for more than just a year, and he sunk. At times, his temperament was not there. But what's interesting in all this, going into next week's podcast, is that we're going to see Yuki Tsunoda back in an F1 car, because unfortunately, Isaac Hadjer hurt his wrist, and he's going to sit out the Dutch Grand Prix. He had a special helmet and everything, making fun of the time he dropped the podium trophy. Hadjer's out. Liam Lawson is going to step back in at Red Bull, which I never thought I'd see the like. And Tsunoda's going to go back at Racing Bulls. I'm just going to wonder, how will that weekend shape all of this that we just talked about and potentially more?
It's certainly going to get people talking because, I mean, there's an F1 side tangent. Liam Lawson going back to Red Bull after his two-race stint there last year. And don't get me wrong, it wasn't great, but I think Red Bull certainly gave him the short end of the stick to try and be any kind of successful over there. That was deeply unfortunate. Lawson's got skeletons in the closet he'd probably want to get rid of there. And in all due respect, Lawson's been brilliant this year in F1. I think he's been so solid.
He's making Red Bull really think, because once again, you have two drivers that are too good to let go of, but also Nikola Soloff is performing very well in Formula 2.
It's a classic three into two doesn't go. Hadjer has been good enough where I don't think there's any serious risk of demotion there. I think Lawson's driven very well this season. I think Lindblad has been an excellent rookie in terms of at least having the raw speed. The head-to-heads aren't so favorable, but the key stat that I like is that on average, Lindblad's been less than a tenth behind Lawson in qualifying.
Yeah.
That's very strong in terms of just outright raw speed. And Nikola Soloff's having a very good first season in Formula 2. It's a good problem to have if you're Red Bull. You've got options. I think Soloff will end up in Super Formula next year because Red Bull love a finishing school prospect like Lawson was before, like Pierre Gasly back in 2017. It wouldn't surprise me if we see him in Japan next year, basically. But there's a lot to atone for. And I think if you're Yuki, it might be in one nice little bit of closure, because Racing Bulls was his team. He'd had 83, I think it was 89 starts he had there. He had some fantastic results over there. He knows that team extremely well. Almost got
on the podium in that one race.
The one we don't talk about. So I think there's a lot of skeletons in closets to claw. I think there's some closure that these drivers are going to want to have. And if it keeps Yuki's name in the headlines, if he, for example, scores points, which is very doable in the Racing Bulls this year, I mean, it's a good car. They've been top five all year in terms of constructors. It'll certainly get some people talking. And
it's all going to depend on qualifying form, because Zandvoort is a tough place to pass. The last Dutch Grand Prix,
Last Dutch Grand Prix, as we know it, they're going to roll out hard for Max. There's going to be a sea of orange on Sunday. It's going to be fun. They're a great crowd, if nothing else. There's going to be, I think, at least 90,000 in the house on the last day. I don't think there's a serious prospect of Max winning, per se, but we'll see what happens. It's a sprint weekend as well, after all. Also, before we go, quick note on silly season as well. Josh Pearson apparently in the frame for an IndyCar seat because allegedly he has $25 million of funding to give to a team. Weird.
So Rogers wanting to pull the plug on Force Indy. Miles Rowe has had wins. They have all been on ovals. His Roan Street course game is not developed. And yada, yada, yada. He's in his mid-20s. Never mind the fact that he's a year younger than Kakuno Shinoto. We were all salivating over the prospect of him coming to IndyCar in 2028. All he wants is at least an Indy 500 shot. And that might fall through the cracks. But Josh Pearson, who I don't mind the kid. I've seen him perform well, especially in sports cars.
He's not dreadful.
But he's accomplished nothing in the last 3 years in this Indy Nets class. If you just want a guy that can at least inject a bit of short-term cash, Enzo Fittipaldi's right there.
You already ran his brother, who was, you know, okay, he drove for RLL and he wasn't great, but it was RLL. We know they suck, you know, and he gave you good money. Like, look, and I've said before, it's a really stacked Indy Next class this year. It's bursting at the seams of younger talent this year. Nikita Johnson's really solid. Alex Tatuli has had 7 poles this year. Timak Kakarczyk is really solid. Max Taylor's really solid. Like, if this talk about Pearson was happening 3 years ago, I'd be like, yeah, sure. Because he was, like, regularly in the top 5 3 years ago in Indy Next. To have this story and have this talk come around now in 2026 when the field has passed him by and we have arguably the most talented top third of the field that Indy Next has had in a hot minute. Now of all times, you're talking about $25 million to jump the queue? Like, it doesn't make a lick of sense to me, but this is IndyCar for you. Like, if you're providing that much funding where you basically pay for your own seat, you're always going to attract the ear of somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I know that there has been a lot of criticism of Mick Schumacher falling up to MSR, but I also know that we haven't seen much of Mick outside of what he's delivered at RLL, and it's been interesting. He's thrown away opportunities. Like, I have to disagree with Dre on something. He does have flashes of oval pace, just not the results.
But the ovals is above average for someone as where he is in IndyCar right now. He's picked up the ovals quicker than the Roden Street tracks. That I will happily concede. The issue I have is that he's only in contention for the seat because of his last name. Call it what it is. A Schumacher driving for the upper echelons of an IndyCar seat is a huge amount of traction for a series that... Look, the Schumacher name is one of the biggest in motorsport in the sense of... You recognize guy in red racing car, you think of Michael. Uh-huh. Like, he's one of those... He's one of the few, maybe 2, 3, or 4 names in the last 30, 50 years of motorsport whose name transcends Formula One circles.
I am a guy...
pass up that sign of opportunity, unfortunately. Yeah. I get it, you know?
Yeah. We're all bigger Mick Schumacher fans than I think a lot of people out there. And we're not even the biggest Mick Schumacher fans that we talk to on a regular basis. I'd love to see it, but if it happens, it better work.
Let's put it to you this way. If it was purely off the results, we'd be laughing this rumor out of the room.
Yeah, pretty much.
Because we're talking because the name that was obvious that was going to pencil it in for that seat was Rinus VK, who's been outstanding this season for Juncos Hollinger. But it looks like Rinus has got a new deal with Juncos anyway. So it looks like he's off the market. So if Rhenus is off the market and apparently Christian Lundgaard's off the market, at that point, you might as well take a punt on who you think is good.
Because let's go gambling!
I think it's very much of a muchness after that point, quite frankly. And if you see the potential in Mick and you think you've got a 500 crack with Mick in your car, he's going to get a gig because that's how this works now. If anything, this season, more than any other, has proven that IndyCar wants more oval specialists at the front of the field. Like Christian Lindgaard losing his job at McLaren, Rhenus VK being a hot name on the driver market until it looks like he signed this new deal with Juncos, Mick being reported for MSR, Will Buxton's one-man mission to get Miles Rowe a 500 seat. It's all leaning towards 500 prevalence again. And
yeah, there's been talk of is Santino Ferrucci's career in jeopardy? And look, for a lot of people that would please them, but I'm here to tell you right now, this is all just going to be a lot of talk before he inevitably re-signs at Foyt. I'm just going to tell you.
he's a guaranteed 500 shot. There's like six dudes in the field that are like that.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to punt on the Freedom 250. I know a lot of people are. You know, if you want to watch, that's fine. If you want to hate watch, that's fine. I'm just too busy. But also next weekend, Formula One's back.
Formula One is back with the Dutch Grand Prix. We do have, look, I will take one for the team and we'll do the usual shit with the Freedom 250 because someone has to and it might as well be me. Because if you don't, people are going to be like, well, Drake, where's the DRR on this? Who cares if it's Donald Trump? Just, do you think I want to do this? I don't. But someone has to and I will fall on that grenade so you don't have to.
I have a built-in work excuse. That's fine. Dutch Grand Prix is going to be great.
Sprint weekend.
Are we expecting more Kimi Antonelli B2A?
I think you know that's the likely scenario here. I want McLaren to make things more interesting. They tend to go well at Zandvoort, but. Because they get their power unit details late because they're the customer to the Mercedes factory team, I always fear they're going to be playing catch-up. But Hungary was intriguing enough where I'm like, oh, McLaren completely dominated this weekend. That might actually make things interesting going forward. I don't know how much of that was just the nature of Hungary as a track, the fact that McLaren's always been a bit more of a tire-sharing team, the fact that Mercedes qualified badly, and qualifying badly in Hungary is normally a death sentence. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see, but I would probably pencil Kimi in as the favourite unless something funky happens out there. Your best shot is probably rain, but the schedule looks pretty clear. So, we'll see.
Yeah. That'll about do it for the IndyCar side of things, I suppose. Oh, and also the Prem starts.
Yeah, Premier League's back. Woo, football. Watch the football. Watch it. It's going to move.
Match that is definitely happening this Sunday.
Yep, I will wrap this up. Go watch Super GT this weekend. RJ O'Connell will be commentating on it. You know, go do the thing. Support our hosts. That would be a really nice thing for you to do. Take it from me. Before we go, let's get the general housekeeping done because I didn't do it at the top of the show. If you want to watch highlights of this show as well as some other bespoke content from yours truly, you can do so on YouTube at Motorsport101 over there. You can do it on our Instagram or our TikTok feeds as well. Motorsport101pod is the username for both of those. Check out highlights of the show. If you believe your podcast should be a visual medium, that's always a fun time. Otherwise, you can check us out on Blue Sky. Both me and RJ are both there with our full names, Dre Harrison and RJ O'Connell.bluesky.social. You can follow the show itself on Twitter as well at motorsport_101. And if you really, really like us, you can back us financially on Patreon. I almost got the name for a second there. Patreon.com/motorsport101. You can donate $5 a month to get all of our shows and content early. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded. Big turnout tonight, actually. So thank you guys for that. Emma, Raptor, Kira, Jason, Max, all, and Vic as well, all in there for the chat. Oh, and before I go as well, thank you all very much for all the birthday wishes. That was very kind of you all. I am now a startling 34 years young. I'm now in the age where sports commentators think you're the oldest athlete to ever do anything ever. Look how washed this guy is.
Still out there.
It's a miracle he's still out there. Look at him go. He's 34. Fuck me. and I'm still only the middle child of the podcasters here in terms of age. Sorry, Rory. as you do. But thank you for all the kind words and the well wishes. I do really, really appreciate that. So thank you. We'll be back next week to talk the Freedom 250 and the Formula One's Dutch Grand Prix. Hopefully Cameron Buckley will get over the coffin fit by then. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison. He's been RJ O'Connell. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll see you guys next week. Sayonara.
Sayonara, y'all. I gotta co-opt that because I'm literally going to Japan in a couple days.
Only fair you had it, really.
Yeah. Go watch the Super GT this weekend if you're in the United States or Canada, please. Thank you.